Good morning. Just a couple of things. One, you're not going to want to miss next week. My understanding is that there's going to be more people up on the stage than there are out there. You know, like a million guitars. It's just going to be a blowout. It's going to be really fun. And then also, go ahead, turn, if you would, to Genesis chapter 32. And I just want to say I'm just so excited about this passage this morning. Some of you know our youngest daughter, Bethany, the little baby of the family. When she would get really excited when she was a little girl, she would just go like this because she was just so excited. And that's how I feel this morning about this passage in Genesis. It's just so terrific for just a lot of different reasons. And maybe it's because it really gets to the heart of what it means to walk with God. And so if you've been with us, you know we've been in this study on the life of Jacob for the past several weeks, and we're actually kind of coming up near the end of it. And you remember Jacob is the grandson of Abraham. He's the guy that had 12 sons that became the 12 tribes that actually became the nation of Israel. And this morning, we're actually going to find out where that name comes from and what that means, because Jacob is going to have a little bit of a name change. But if there was ever a man who found himself between the devil and the deep blue sea, it's Jacob the day he leaves behind his father-in-law, Laban, and he meets up with his brother, Esau. And if you were with us last week, you remember at the end of Genesis 31, Laban, his father-in-law, is behind him, and he can't go back. They did not part on friendly terms, and the deal was that if either of them crossed the boundary marker left at Gilead, the other would regard that as an enemy invasion. And as a result, Jacob now has his back up against the rock of this binding covenant. He can't retreat. He has nowhere to go except forward, but ahead of him is a hard place. And that would be the territory of his twin brother Esau. And you remember 20 years before, he had cheated his brother out of his birthright, and as a result of his deception, he had to run for his life. Now, you remember his mother, Rebekah, had said that when Esau cooled off, you know, because Esau wanted to kill him over this, that she would send word for him to come back. But word never came. And in fact, sadly, she actually died while he was away. And so for all Jacob knows, Esau is just as ready to dispatch him as a wounded deer as he was the day he left. But what Jacob doesn't know is this. Laban and Esau are the least of his worries. The treacherous Laban might be behind him, the murderous Esau might be in front of him, but in the middle he has to wrestle with God, literally. And so this morning we come to the famous scene pictured in the image in the slide that we've been using for the whole study series. It's Jacob and the angel, or as Matt put it, you know, stop hitting yourself. Because that's what it looks like up there, doesn't it? Look at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 32. Here we go. Now, as Jacob went on his way, he's left Laban behind him now. He's moving forward towards Esau. We hear that the angels met him, and Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp, and so he named that place Mahanaim, which, by the way, means two camps. And it probably has the idea there's his camp, and then there's God's camp. And God lifts the veil on the unseen world and shows him this small army of angels. Now, you would think this would be good news, right? He's afraid for his life. He's anxious. His nerves are as raw as red meat hanging in a butcher shop. He's terribly afraid, so you would think that having an army of angels on your flank would be a confidence builder. You know, this is great. You know, God has sent the Marines, you know, in to protect me. But apparently, he didn't take it that way. He kind of took it as a bad sign, a bad omen. He's thinking, you know, oh boy, if God has to send in the Marines, I must be in deeper trouble than I thought, because he's got to send all these guys in to help me. Or maybe, just maybe, Jacob is a whole lot like us. We would rather have a visible army rather than an invisible one. We'd rather live by sight rather than faith. And so we live in fear. At any rate, these angels don't seem to calm Jacob's nerves, and we see that in what we read next. Look at verses 3 through 5. And then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he also commanded them, saying, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent them sent to tell my lord that I might find favor in your sight." In other words, Jacob, he trips all over himself trying to be conciliatory. When he sends the messengers, he says, "I want you to be really polite. I want you to call him Lord, and you call me servant." And then what happens next is kind of funny. Look at verse 6. And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." In other words, the messengers are so terrified, they don't even deliver the message. And when they return and report what they saw, let's just say Jacob could use a change of underwear. You know, because he's thinking he's just going to meet Esau alone. But it's not just Esau, you know, coming out with nunchucks or a baseball bat or whatever. It's the entire Western division of the NFL. It's Esau plus 400 of his hunting buddies. You know, and they got the camo on, they got the face paint, they got some arrows with really pointy ends on them and everything. And so this is not good news. Now, if you know the rest of the story, you might wonder why Esau seems ready for a fight, because we learn later that Esau, in fact, is cooled off. He's calmed down over the last two decades. But the answer is to look at the situation from Esau's perspective, because he has no idea what Jacob's intentions are either. I remember 20 years before, Jacob has stolen his birthright, and for all Esau knows, Jacob is now coming back to take the promised territory and maybe even make him a slave. And so although Esau is no longer angry, he's prepared for the worst. And the effect on Jacob is immediate and palpable. And in his panic, he does two things. First he plans, and then he prays. Look at verse 7 and 8. "And then Jacob was greatly distressed with this news." Okay, wow, I got a whole army coming against me. "And he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. For he said, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape." That's the plan. He divides the company into two, and for a good reason. You know, if Esau comes and he wipes out, you know, one of the companies, one of the camps, then the other might possibly escape. And it's a good plan, I guess. But you can tell that he expects the worst by what he does next. He prays. And I don't know if you've been keeping track of this. We've been with Jacob, I don't know how many chapters now. I think this is the first time he's prayed. Kind of like C.S. Lewis said, he said, you know, most people regard God the way a pilot regards his parachute. You know, it's there for emergencies, but he hopes he never has to use it. And that's Jacob. And now he's got to come to God. Here's his prayer. Verses 9 through 12. And it's a good one. When he finally gets around to it, it's a good one. "And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered." Now, you can tell that Jacob is in a panic right from the start, because he pulls out all the stops. And I find it mildly amusing that Jacob operates a lot like we do when we're under pressure. We work out a solution to our problem, and it's only when we're at the end of the absolute end of our resources that then we start to pray. We kind of get things backwards. The first thing we should do is often the last thing. And there's nothing wrong with planning. In fact, you know, most of us probably ought to plan more than we do. The trouble is we tend to plan first, and then we ask God to bless whatever plans we've already made. It's like the pastor, he came home one day to his wife, came home, and he says, honey, the church in Joysville, you know, has offered me the pastorate. You know, and it's a bigger church, the pay is better, the people are nicer. What do you think we should do? And his wife said, well, I think we should pray about it. And he said, good idea. You stay down here and pray. I'll go upstairs and pack. And that's what we do, right? That said, when Jacob finally gets around to praying, it's a pretty good prayer. For one thing, he prays passionately. But of course, it's amazing, you know, how well you can pray when you think you might die the next day. He humbly confesses his unworthiness. He praises God for his faithfulness, reminds God of his promises. Don't forget what you said, God, just reminding you. And then finally, he makes a direct request for deliverance. Unfortunately, as soon as he finishes praying, fear comes through the door, faith goes out the window. He's back to his plan, verses 13 through 21. And so he spent the night there, and then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls. Sounds like the 12 days of Christmas here, doesn't it? 20 female donkeys, 10 male donkeys, and he delivered them into the hands of his servants, every drove by itself. And he said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between the droves. So he's gonna spread this thing out. It's going to take a long time to get through. Pass on before me and put a space between the droves, he commanded the one in front, saying, and when my brother Esau meets you and asks, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going? And to whom do these animals in front of you belong? Then you shall say, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present to my lord Esau. And behold, he is also behind us. And then he commanded also the second and the third and all those who followed the drove, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob is also behind us. And for he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. And then afterward I will see his face and he will, perhaps he will accept me. And so the present passed on before him while he himself spent the night in the camp. Now, Jacob's still afraid, so he revises the plan a little bit. He's hoping to appease Esau with some gifts. You will notice that there is no cat on the list. Esau is not a cat person. Esau eats cats for breakfast. But I want to read something to you. This is from James Boyce in his commentary on Genesis. And listen to what he says about this scene. So Jacob has sent all of his possessions, and in the next verses we're going to learn that he also sends his family as well. And this is what he says. Jacob had given up his possessions, even his family. But he was the same old Jacob. He had not given up himself. This is what we do. We go to church and sing, all to Jesus I surrender, all to him I freely give. I will ever love and trust him, in his presence daily live. I surrender all to thee, my blessed Savior, I surrender all. But then he goes on. He says, but what we really mean is, I surrender all the goats. I surrender all the sheep. And it is not. And if that is not enough, I surrender all the cows. We will give up money, time, and family, our dearest possessions. But we do not give up ourselves. And the time has come when God sends his angel to wrestle us to personal submission. And I think that is Jacob's problem. I think he's right about that. Jacob's core issue, core problem, is one of surrender. He had met God 20 years before, but he continued to do things his own way. And so in the next scene, God gives Jacob a crash course on the subject. And that's what I meant when I said earlier that Laban and Esau were the least of his worries. Jacob is hoping that a whole lot of presents will keep his brother from killing him, but he doesn't know if it's going to work. And so it keeps him awake. Verses 22 through 24. And now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And he took them and he sent them across the stream and he sent across whatever he had. And then Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Jacob can't sleep, and for a good reason. In the morning, he is going to face the brother who had promised to kill him 20 years before. Imminent death has a way of keeping you awake at night. And some of you, know how it is on those nights when you can't sleep, and you know you need to do something. You're just tossing and turning and rolling back and forth. And so what do? Well, you nudge your spouse, right? And you say, honey, are you awake? Jacob, he wakes up his whole family. And he moves them across the river in the middle of the night. And so he sent everything else. The only thing left is Jacob himself. And he settles down by this little gurgling stream. And he looks upward at the blinking stars in the desert sky. He starts to drift off. When suddenly, out of the darkness, a shadowy figure grabs him by the shoulders and pulls him out from under his blankets, out of his sleeping bag. And remember, he doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know if this is a roving bandit who's going to beat him up for his clothes. Or even more likely, this is an assassin that was sent ahead by Esau to cut his throat. And so he's fighting for his life. He finds himself in hand-to-hand combat with an unknown attacker. He's in the middle of nowhere. There's no cell phone coverage. He can't call 911. As far as he knows, he's fighting for his life. But who is he fighting with? Well, at first, he's simply identified as a man. But then as the passage progresses, it becomes clear that this is more than a mere man. And in fact, this is interesting. The prophet Hosea tells us that Jacob wrestled with an angel. But then it turns out that it's not just any angel. Do you remember the angel back earlier in Genesis? That came to Abraham. And you remember who he turned out to be? It was God himself. And by the end of the struggle, Jacob comes to the same realization. This is no mere man. It's not even an angel. This is God himself in human form. But Jacob doesn't know that yet. All he knows is that he's rolling in the dirt. He's fighting for his life. And this is where, being a shepherd for 20 years pays off. He holds his own. Look at verse 25. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So that the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Now, how long they wrestled, we're not told, because we don't know what time Jacob actually went to bed. But we're at least left with the impression that it kind of went on and on for a long time, at least until both men should have been too tired to move, much less be able to hurt each other. And this is where Jacob gets the first clue as to who it is that he's wrestling with. That he's wrestling with someone a whole lot more powerful than himself. because all the man does is reach out and touch him and dislocates his hip. And what's interesting is that the word touch is the word used in Isaiah 6 of the coal that the angel brought with tongs and touched Isaiah's lips. In other words, this touch was as soft as a kiss, but it crippled Jacob for the rest of his life. Why the thigh? Why the thigh? Because that's the strongest muscle in the human body. It's a symbol of Jacob's reliance on his own ability. And with his strength diminished, all he can do is now he's just clinging to God for all that it's worth. Look at verses 26 and 27. And then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And so he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." When God tells the wounded Jacob to let go, he won't do it. And at first, that sounds like the old Jacob that we've come to know and love. He's as stubborn and defiant, you know, as a fire hydrant. He says, "I'm not letting you go." But again, what's interesting, in the Old Testament prophet Hosea, in chapter 12, we're told that after he wrestled with the angel and prevailed, that is, he didn't get killed, we're told that Jacob wept and sought his favor. He was weeping. Why was that? Have you ever dislocated something? Is that, I mean, you ever had it like a dislocated finger, you know, or your shoulder? Now try to imagine a dislocated hip. You think that's going to hurt? I mean, just multiply. Imagine the pain of that. Jacob's not defiant. He's in tears. This isn't a defiant demand. It's a tearful request. And in response, his assailant asks his name. Now, here's a question. If this is God, doesn't he know Jacob's name? Well, of course he does. You know, God is like any good attorney. He never asks a question that he doesn't know the answer to. But there are two things that are going on here. First, in those days, to demand a name was the equivalent of asking someone to say uncle. You remember that? Maybe when you were growing up, if you're old like me, you know, say uncle. It's the equivalent of asking someone to say uncle. In other words, yielding your name was an act of surrender and submission. So that's first. And second, in the ancient world, a name wasn't just a label to distinguish between people. It was actually a symbol of your character and your personality. And for Jacob to confess his name, give his name, was to confess his character. Remember what his name means? Jacob. You know, a heel grabber, one who trips others up. It had the idea of a deceiver or a cheater. And so he's confessing his character. And these two things are important for two different reasons. Number one, there is no way for a human being to come to God that does not involve surrender. There is no way for a human being to come to God that does not involve surrender. And second, in order to walk with God into the future, we need to own up to our past. And Jacob does both. 28 and 29. And he said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." And then Jacob asked him and said, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. After Jacob surrendered and confessed his character, God blessed him with a new name and with a new identity. He gives him the name that we're so familiar with, Israel. It means one who strives with God. But it also contains the idea of God fights. One who strives with God, God fights. In other words, this name would remind Jacob for the rest of his life, and later the nation of Israel, of a great truth. In life, in all of life, it is with God that we have to deal. We have to bear with God. Our struggle ultimately is with God. Not other people, it's not other circumstances. Ultimately, we have to bear with God. But it's also God who fights our battles. Now, at this point, Jacob is pretty much out of steam. But he has just enough breath for a final request. And he says, "Who are you? I've told you who I am. Who are you? What's your name?" And R.C. Sproul, in his book, The Holiness of God, writes about this scene, and I think gives some insight to it. He says, in defeat, Jacob is still hoping for a draw. A tie in the contest would leave his pride intact. Even a split decision would help. And he said to the angel, "Please tell me your name." He says this. Note the difference in the name exchange issue. The angel demanded Jacob's name, and Jacob surrendered it. Jacob politely requested the angel's name and did not get it. This was the final act of divine conquest. There are no draws with God, no split decisions. When we wrestle with the Almighty, we lose. He is the undefeated champion of the universe. But then he has another little paragraph here, and I'm just going to throw this in for free because I think it's really good. He says, the Holy One cannot be defeated in personal combat. But there is some consolation here. Jacob wrestled with God and lived. He was beaten. He was left crippled. But he survived the battle. And at least we can learn from this that God will engage us in our honest struggles. Isn't that good? It's okay to wrestle with God. He says we may wrestle with the Holy One. But also notice that Jacob received a blessing. Meaning what? Well, meaning that Jacob lost the battle, but in his surrender, he gained something better. Out of his submission came a blessing. Someone has said, when we fight, we lose, but when we lose, we gain. When we fight, we lose, but when we lose, we gain. Our brokenness is the beginning of blessing. So in giving Jacob his new name, one who strives with God, the wrestler also revealed his identity. God didn't give up his name, but now Jacob knows. Verses 30 through 32. And so Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been reserved. Now the sun rose upon him, just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. And then the writer adds a little footnote here for us. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip. Can you picture this scene as Jacob walks away? Can you see his limp because of the wound that God inflicted on his hip? Can you see his halting gait? Can you see his uneven stride? And if you squint just right, you can see his shadow as it stretches out the length of a football field as the first blush of this desert sun peeks over the rim of the earth. And did you happen to notice that little phrase, the sun rose upon him? Do you remember, this was a number of weeks ago, and I mentioned it in passing, probably didn't pay that much attention to it, but do you remember what we were told 20 years before when Jacob left home? We're told that darkness fell upon him. But now, after 20 wasted years, we're told the sun rose upon him and he walks in the light. And for the first time in 20 years, his walk with God is what it should be. He walks in the light, but he walks with a limp as a permanent reminder of his need to lean on God rather than himself. And of course, the best thing that could happen to any of us is that God would leave us limping if that's what it takes to make us lean on him rather than ourselves. A guy by the name of David Roper has written a little book on Jacob. It's subtitled, The Fools God Chooses, which is a great subtitle. And I want to read what he writes about this passage. He says, because God so loves us, he does not want to lose us. And so he pits his strength against ours. And he will touch whatever it is that causes us to stand against him. Our dreams may fail, our businesses may fold, our best laid plans may go awry. An accident may impair us, a crippling disease might ruin us, we might simply grow old. Our bodies once strong begin to weaken, our minds once sharp begin to fail. He has touched us and stripped us of our natural strength and ability. These effects are not signs of God's wrath and displeasure, but evidences of his love. He is working through all of this, wrestling with us, dusting us up, bringing us down to take from us all that hinders his love. He will not give up until we are wholly his. Jacob limped away from his encounter, diminished, halting on his thigh. His maiming marked him forever, but if you were to ask him about his infirmity, he would tell you that the best day of his life was the day that God put him to the mat. That was the night that Jacob lost everything he had and gained everything worth having. This is, like I said at the beginning, this is one of my favorite passages, one of my favorite sections, you know, in the entire Bible. I love it because it's a picture of God's patience. It's a lesson on the lengths that God will go to make us into the kind of people that he wants us to be. It's a story about God's love that is so great that he will break us if that's what it takes to bless us. It reminds us that God is in the business of changing lives. And it's to our advantage to surrender to the process. There is no way for a human being to come to God that does not involve surrender. One of my favorite writers says, in surrender, I let go of my life. It is a Copernican revolution of the soul in which I take myself out of the center of the universe and place God there. I yield to him. I offer obedience. I do what he says. I go his way rather than my way. He leads. I follow. Have you been wounded? You walk with a limp, maybe physically, emotionally, psychologically, maybe even spiritually. The good news is that God only fights battles with wounded soldiers. God only fights battles with wounded soldiers. He wants to use your wound for His glory. Don't waste it. You think about that. So will you pray with me? Lord, as we come to this table this morning, we're reminded that Jesus Himself knew the pain of surrender. As He knelt in the garden, He prayed, let this cup pass from me, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And we are reminded in the Lord's Supper that just as surrender led to resurrection for Jesus, it leads to our resurrection and life for us. In the name of your Son and our Savior, we pray. Amen.